Welcome to AMA Edgewise. I'm Dave Summers. AMA Edgewise is brought to you by the American Management Association. The current conventional wisdom in the business world holds that execution is the key to a successful business strategy. Many experts have gone so far as to say that execution is more important than strategy. But according to Paul Carroll, the co-author of the new book, Billion Dollar Lessons, and a former Pulitzer Prize-nominated journalist for the Wall Street Journal, looking back at the history of business failures teaches us that there are some strategies that are prone to disaster no matter how well they're executed. He joins us here today on Edgewise. Paul, welcome to the program.
Great to be here.
So we've heard a lot from experts who say that execution is the be-all and end-all, and even a flawed strategy can be successful with great execution. Now, you feel pretty strongly that that's a gravely mistaken notion. Why do you think that?
My co-author, Chunka Moy, and I decided that people focus too much on success, not enough on failure. There are tons of business books, Built to Last, Good to Great, a ton of other books that take a look at successes and say, here's how to be like those guys. We thought it was important to look at failures and say, here's how not to be like those guys. So we assembled a database of 2,500 failures, write-offs, bankruptcies, and so forth, and had a team of 20 researchers spend about a year and a half working over the data to beat it into submission and make it yield up its secrets. What we found is that almost half of the failures stemmed from a bad strategy. Going in, we thought maybe they'd be 20%, 25%, given what people are saying about the importance of execution. But we found that 46% of the failures we studied were based on a seriously bad strategy, and no amount of good execution would have saved them.
So a bad plan is a bad plan, no matter which way you look at it.
Right. Execution matters, but what we're saying is it's not enough. You also have to really focus on getting the strategy right.
Now, in your book, you identify strategies that more often than not lead to disaster when companies follow them.
We found seven strategies. There were some strategies that could be successful, others that almost always failed. It varies. For instance, we looked at roll-ups, buying a whole bunch of companies and combining them into one to try to get some efficiencies. We found that almost always led to failure. Maybe there was some initial success, but that almost always led to failure. There were others like moves into adjacent markets that in the right hands can work very well. Jack Welch used to do that sort of thing. He would look at his jet engine operation at GE and say, don't think of yourselves as just being the jet engine market. Think of yourselves as a bigger part of the ecosystem of airlines. So those guys then began selling what they called power by the hour. And the whole idea was to keep a plane on the ground for maintenance as little time as possible. Very successful. GE made a lot of money doing that. But what we found is that moves into adjacent markets have very little in common if you look at the success stories. Each success was different from the last. Each failure was very similar. So we raised red flags there. There were synergy strategies, consolidation. Financial engineering is another one that almost always led to disaster. There were technology issues that sometimes worked well if people tried to do a strategy based on a new technology. But in any case, the real issue is we were trying to raise these red flags for these seven strategies so you could sort out the likely failures from the likely successes.
Okay.
And even if you're doing something that maybe is an iffy strategy, if you follow some of the guidelines we lay out, you can mitigate any problems. If you're doing a technology strategy, you don't do something like Iridium. They were satellite telephone started by Motorola, which basically set itself up so that it had to follow all the way through. There was no way to kill it. They invested $5 billion to get the system up and running. It was up less than a year before it filed for bankruptcy. It was liquidated, and the $5 billion of assets were sold for $25 million. Not a good setup. So all we're saying is that even if you are off on a bad strategy, and Iridium clearly was a bad strategy from day one, at least if you set it up right, you give yourself a chance to kill it so that you only lose $1 billion, not $5 billion or $500 million or whatever it is.
Now, many of the strategic decisions that you recount in the book, they're just misguided. But some are so outright baffling that you just have to say to yourself, what were they thinking? One of the biggest of these is the Avon Company's decision to purchase a chain of nursing homes in the 1980s.
Avon actually initially did a very smart thing. In the 80s, they were seeing that more women were working. That meant that there were fewer women at home to buy cosmetics when the Avon ladies came calling. So they thought, maybe we can find things beyond cosmetics that our sales force can sell. And they thought there were certain medical products, pills, vitamins, whatever, that these women might be interested in buying. Lo and behold, they were. So Avon got a nice bump in revenue by thinking broadly about their market. Well, Avon then got a little carried away, and they decided that they actually understood the medical market. So they thought, all right, well, let's get into the market for medical equipment. Well, that's a heavily regulated market, had nothing to do with cosmetics. It didn't build at all on Avon's biggest asset, which was its sales force. Avon went even beyond that. They decided if they were in the medical equipment market, then they understood the patients and they ought to get into retirement homes. So they bought a chain of retirement homes. Again, this had nothing to do with anything that Avon knew about. It actually turned out that they were moving into a heavily regulated market. So they lost their shirts. It clearly was a problem of management. Avon bought these two operations for something like $600 million, wrote off about 85% of the investment. They actually bought one business from some operators for about $350 million. After a couple years, sold it back to them for $100 million. These guys operated the business for 2 years and sold it to somebody else for $500 million. So it was all in the operation. There are a number of lessons I think you can take away from that. The broad lesson is that even really successful executives can do stupid things. It's kind of tempting to think that you can't if you're an executive, because the guys who run businesses are the best and the brightest. They've gone to the best schools, they've had the best grades, they've had the best careers, they've never made a mistake. But if you look at the people who ran Avon, who decided that they really weren't about cosmetics and a sales force, they were about a culture of caring, which is how they justified the medical equipment and then the retirement homes. Even really bright people can make mistakes. So just because you are the best and the brightest doesn't mean that you, in certain circumstances, won't get caught up in that kind of a problem as well.
With so much history to learn from, it's a little surprising that companies continue to adopt disastrous strategies. It's not just limited to a few naive companies either. Many of the companies you discuss in your book, they're big, successful companies that really should know better. Why do companies have such a hard time learning these lessons?
In a lot of ways, it is baffling to me. If you take a look at the financial crisis we're going through now, great companies, Merrill Lynch, Lehman Brothers, Bear Stearns, made mistakes that companies had made 10 years ago. If you take a look at the history of GreenTree Financial, long-term capital management, those companies 10 years ago were making the same bad assumptions about risk, about subprime borrowers, and about securitization that led to the mess we're in now. The best explanation is that there really are two sorts of pressures that tend to push businesses toward making mistakes. One is a personal psychological sort of pressure. It turns out that for a lot of reasons we lay out in the book, people are inclined to think they're going to be more successful than they really will be. They're also inclined not to learn lessons from failure because they rationalize things. If something goes well, it's because I'm a smart guy. If something goes wrong, it's your fault, or it's the environment, or it's bad luck, or it's something. So people tend not to want to learn these lessons. There also are a lot of organizational pressures. If a CEO has an idea, he may say, okay, tell me why it's wrong. But people aren't stupid. They can read between the lines. The CEO really wants to be told how this is a great idea. And the whole operation becomes fleshing out the idea, basically making it work rather than having it not work. There are also issues about compensation, group dynamics, and so forth. It turns out it's a really complicated problem for a business to head off these sorts of mistakes before they get to market.
I think just from a human factor standpoint, people want to believe almost magically that it's going to be different this time.
Right. And as I said, these executives have never had a big problem. So even if there have been times in the past when they've rolled the dice and maybe had only a 50% chance of having some big bet work, they've succeeded. So they're inclined to think they'll always succeed.
You know, it's interesting. Even the United States Army, after the Gulf War, formed a special unit called the Center for Lessons Learned. What they did was they amassed a whole pile of information about stuff that happened on the ground, stuff that happened with supply lines, stuff that happened with local cultures, and now they utilize it through a web-based solution and a telephone support line. But the point was, somebody cared enough within this institution to say, we've got all this learning, we've got all these battle scars and all these bad stories to tell, let's learn from them. You figure somebody would do that.
That's part of what we're trying to do. It turns out that hospitals are pretty good. They certainly go back and do reviews when there's a problem. The Army is quite good. And airlines actually are probably the best. The reason is if a plane crashes, the pilot goes down with the plane. So people who are involved in airlines aren't just saving other people's lives like doctors are. They're maybe saving their own lives. So they tend to be really careful about that.
You also propose that to avoid making costly strategic blunders, companies should adopt something that you call the devil's advocate approach.
We tried to look at organizations that successfully avoided big problems. We actually go all the way back to the ancient Persians, who, as it turned out, made every decision twice, once when they were sober and once when they were drunk. If those decisions agreed, then they went ahead. Well, it turns out that businesses are in an emotional state when they make a major decision because of some of the dynamics I talked about. Sometimes there's pressure in the market, whatever. There just is a lot of emotion that goes into a big decision. So what we are recommending is that as long as they're making a decision when they're not drunk, but in a hot state, make the same decision when they're in a cold state. There are analogies from business going back to General Motors in the early days with Alfred B. Sloan to IBM under Tom Watson Jr. And what we're suggesting is that people need to find a way to get constructive contention into the strategy setting process. We're not saying go back and come up with a new strategy process. We're saying that after you get through that process as an overlay, what you need to do is evaluate the decision by fostering as much disagreement as possible. Wouldn't say come in and tell us whether this strategy is right. Just come in and raise all the possible questions so that you get all the issues on the table. And we know from experience that if you do that sort of thing, then you're not going to have the cement company decide to get into the lawnmower market because cement's used in homes and homes have lawns. That kind of mistake is going to get caught before it gets public.
Finally, but perhaps most pertinent, given the current white-hot economic situation that's happening, what lessons do you think we can learn from the fall of Lehman Brothers, the trouble that AIG is in, and other financial companies right now?
I hope the lesson people will learn is that it really is important to learn the lessons of the past. As I said, if you go back and look at Green Tree in detail, you look at long-term capital management, those lessons were there, and people just chose to ignore them. And you can see the kind of mess we're in. Mistakes that other companies make aren't necessarily going to put us in a situation where the financial system may be coming down around our ears. But I still think that what's going on now shows that you really need to study lessons. If you're going to do something, you need to look for an historical analogy that you can base things on. You need to not just look at the successes, which is the temptation, but you also need to go back and see where the strategy you're thinking of pursuing failed, because that's the only way you get a realistic sense of whether you're going to have this thing work.
The title of the book is Billion Dollar Lessons, and one of the authors, Paul Carroll, has been our guest today. Paul, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
As always, we'd love to get your feedback, so please drop us an email at podcast@amanet.org or call us at 800-697-3406. That's 800-697-3406. Thanks for taking us along. I'm Dave Summers, and you've been listening to AMA's Edgewise.